Okay, listen up. This is urgent. Federal funding was taken away this month, and we need your help to fill that gap. Our only option is to raise the money together. We've still got $500,000 left to close our funding gap. Your gift in any amount can turn this around. This is your moment to protect the stories that only Chicago can tell. Please make a monthly gift at wbez.org/donate.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
It's Friday, and boy, do we have news for you. Time to catch up on what's been happening lately across the city and state in our weekly news recap, where we take you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
State Senator Emil Jones testifies for a second day in his federal bribery trial.
Residents say they've seen an increase in the number of tents popping up in Gompers Park.
Will Mayor Johnson's affordable housing plan make it through the city council?
He wants the city of Chicago to create its own nonprofit.
Large groups of teens are expected to gather downtown.
So far this year, a 15-year-old boy was grazed by a bullet and a tourist shot in the arm.
Alderman Andre Vasquez argued banning insurrectionists from employment is a no-brainer.
I guess we'll go for a vote and see who's pro or anti-domestic terrorism.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. This week's panel included Heather Sharone, Chicago politics reporter for WTTW, Ray Long, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and for the first time on the news recap, Lisa Curion-Phillip, higher education reporter for WBEZ. We kicked off with the city council. Alders have approved an ordinance related to the January 6th riots at the U.S. Capitol. Here's Heather with the details.
Well, this resolution would ban those 1,500 people or so who participated in the January 6th Capitol insurrection, were then convicted of that for that conduct and then pardoned by President Trump from working for the city of Chicago. Now, this implements essentially what Governor J.B. Pritzker did on his own on the state level. Mm-hmm. Soon after Donald Trump took office again, he put out an executive order that instructed state hiring officials not to hire anyone who had been pardoned, but Mayor Brandon Johnson declined to do so in the same. So the city council stepped in, and the result was a 44-3 vote.
Yeah, and aldermanic comments on the issue got heated, Heather. Here's the 40th Ward's Andre Vasquez.
But I guess if we're thinking about drawing a line, yeah, domestic terrorism is probably the line, right? Maybe somebody trying to break into a Capitol building might be a step too far to work in government.
So as you said, only three alders voted against this, Heather, and they're all from the same general area.
That's right.
Interesting.
The far northwest side, it was Alderman Anthony Napolitano, Alderman Jim Gardner, and Alderman Nicholas Sposato. Now, if you know anything about the far northwest side, you know that that's home to a number of police officers and firefighters. Of course, there were nearly 150 police officers who were injured during the insurrection, and five died as a result of the injuries that they sustained.
That's right. You know, Ray, though 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez voted for the bill, he said that it's going to set a dangerous precedent. You think he's got a point?
Well, you know, I do think that there is some merit to saying, hey, these guys who stormed the Capitol do not deserve to have jobs in government. There is argument that this is a free society and all that, but, you know, if that's on your resume, it's not exactly a positive thing that you would immediately embrace.
Right.
So I can see why this was so overwhelmingly approved, and I think that not too many people are going to get firebombed because of this vote on this proposal.
Yeah. Meanwhile, City Council did not move forward with an earlier teen curfew for downtown. Tell us what happened with the proposal from Second Ward Alderman Brian Hopkins, Heather.
Well, he was going to use a rule that would have allowed, with the vote of a supermajority of the city council, sort of immediate consideration of his proposal, which would have imposed an 8 p.m. curfew in the downtown business district as opposed to the current 10 p.m. business district. But he said that he had crafted sort of a new proposal,
okay,
and that he was going to hold sort of a regular business sort of procedure with that one. And that one would essentially allow Chicago police to declare snap curfews anywhere in the city, because we know that these quote unquote teen trends or teen takeovers don't just happen downtown.
Right. The most recent was that Hyde Park?
Right. They've been in Hyde Park. There was, you know, sort of talk that there was going to be one on the northwest side near, mm-hmm, you know, Damon and Ogden. And so his point was that members of the city council had come to him and said, look, we think this is a great idea, but we don't want it to just apply to downtown. How can we do it citywide? Now,
yeah.
So in the next couple of weeks, there's supposed to be a committee hearing about it, a vote potentially, and then it would go back to the city council. But there are, I think, to put it mildly, a number of concerns about the legality of this measure.
Yeah.
Because there is a high bar for Chicago police to sort of declare an assembly unlawful because of that pesky First Amendment,
yes,
that allows the right of assembly. And it can be tricky for police to decide what is an inappropriate gathering and what is a protest, what is a peaceful gathering, and what is something that poses a risk to passersby.
So people are still critical of, even though it's more of a compromise now where it's like, you know, just we'll just impose this as needed throughout the city, some people are still like, no.
Well, and also I think it's important to note that the Chicago police already have the power to declare any assembly unlawful and to issue dispersal orders, which is what they did in Streeterville when we had those incidents of violence. And I think that there are going to be a lot of questions about the appropriateness of sort of giving the police an additional tool,
yeah,
whether that tool will be used appropriately by a police department that is under a federal court order to reform itself for violating the constitutional rights of Black and Latino Chicagoans. And I think you're going to hear a lot of concern that in this era of sort of renewed protest against the federal government, whether this kind of tool could be something that could be weaponized by perhaps officials that don't have Chicagoans' best interests at heart.
Interesting. Ray and Lisa, yeah, what are your thoughts on the city's been talking about handling these teen gatherings for quite some time. Lisa?
Yeah. You know, I meet with young people and like
All the time.
All the time. And educators who work with young people, and a lot of the concerns they raise, especially for people working with Black and Latino youth, is that they don't have enough other venues, like after school programming, et cetera, like facilities in their communities, mm-hmm, to gather. And if you are simply trying to apply curfews, that you're not really dealing with the root causes of the issue. Yeah.
True. What comes to mind, Ray?
You know, there was a real incredible story that we had a couple of weeks ago following the Streeterville gathering. And Michelle Lee, who is a CTA board member, is also wheelchair bound, and she was out that night and she had to call 911 to get home because the streets were blocked and she was scared. And she's made the point that, you know, we got to get things under control. The issue now ranges from safety to what do kids do to is this idea of kind of a giving police the ability to throw down a dragnet too much? Is that stopping?
I mean, they're getting a lot more power in their hands through this so-called compromise.
Stop and frisk on steroids, or what is it? So there is no easy solution to these things, but we don't want the kind of action that we've had, like when they had to raise the bridges during the COVID epidemic and the George Floyd time.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know,
Well, Heather, what was it that changed Mayor Johnson's mind? Because he was so opposed to that earlier curfew before.
So, you know, I get paid by WTTW to listen carefully to what the mayor says. And I think if you go back and listen to what he said, he has expressed a willingness to talk to people and try to reach compromise. I did not hear him endorse this specific ordinance.
Okay.
And I think that a lot of sort of the compromise language is coming directly from Alderman Hopkins. And sometimes when you don't have enough votes to force a vote, sometimes you say, well, I'm going to take a different tack.
Yeah.
And that puts off sort of a decisive vote. You know, the mayor's been very clear that he doesn't see curfews as sort of the answer to this question, and that it has a potential of just shifting problems from one area of the city to the other. However, he has not been consistent on this issue. Mm-hmm. Lori Lightfoot, when she was mayor, imposed basically a teen curfew on Millennium Park.
Yeah,
he
I remember
campaigned
that.
Against that. It is entering its fourth summer, and he has not moved to lift it. And he could do that directly without asking the city council for anything. And so I think some of the questions need to be asked, well, are we having these sort of issues in Streeterville because the kids can't go to Millennium Park?
Mm-hmm.
Is that evidence of what the mayor is saying, that this would happen if there was a greater downtown curfew?
Right.
I don't know the answer to those questions.
So the key here, listen to what Mayor Johnson says and also watch what he's not doing.
Right.
More city council news because, of course, the Finance Committee, it approved funding for some development projects that could breathe some new life into the Loop. So tell us what's coming to the financial district, Heather.
Well, so we've got those huge, gorgeous landmark buildings that were really built for a different era of work downtown. These are skyscrapers that once housed literally hundreds of offices where people worked from 9 to 5 in a kind of business that just doesn't exist anymore. So the city is going to use specifically for these two projects $66 million in subsidies to help the development companies to transform these old bank buildings into essentially high-rise condos and apartments. And in return, the developers of these projects have said, we will set aside at least 30% for Chicagoans who earn a little bit less than most people who live downtown. Mm. And this is designed to sort of no longer have the financial district be a neighborhood that was only a place that really sort of had any sort of vibrancy between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. and sort of make it another Chicago neighborhood where people live and work and eat and play. Whether it will be successful, I think, is a really open question. But there's no doubt that the COVID pandemic and the shift to remote work has left a lot of cities sort of struggling to figure out, like, what are we going to do about our downtowns?
Yeah, how are we going to get people to come back down
right.
there? So many conversations so far about
right.
like what to do with the Loop. Yeah, interesting. The mayor's housing initiative also seems to have stalled in the city council. Before you tell us why that happened, just remind us, what does he want to do?
So it's a really, it's a new concept, not just for Chicago, but really nationwide. The city, under this proposal, would create its own nonprofit housing developer that would essentially have the financial wherewithal to take the place of private equity funds or other sort of financial institutions to get these affordable housing projects sort of off the ground. And that they would do this sort of separate from the city, fueled with about $135 million that the city council agreed to borrow about a year ago as part of sort of a larger sort of turn away from the use of tax increment financing districts to fuel, like, you know, rehabilitation for buildings mm-hmm. and neighborhoods and that sort of thing. So, but since it's so new, a lot of city council members had a lot of questions.
Is that why it's stalled?
So I think that's part of it. The other part of it is that nobody's quite sure sort of who this board will report to, what sort of rules they will be under. Will they be subject to the jurisdiction of the inspector general? Will these potential new workers who work for this housing nonprofit, will they be unionized? What sort of ethical rules are they going to have to follow? And the mayor's administration tried to sort of get this from introduction to vote in a very quick timeline. And you know, the mayor has had a deep, deep, t- trouble getting the city council to sort of go along with what he wants to do.
It's always a tug of war.
Yeah, and he was just simply unable to answer all of the questions and overcome that deep skepticism about his administration's ability to sort of pull these levers in an appropriate way.
Well, you don't know if there's going to be scrutiny either. So is this group going to have itself be subject to freedom of information, doubtful under the current construction. So there needs to be more visibility, more transparency. There needs to be some way to have a check and balance on this.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad you're not on the city council beat, Lisa?
Oh, yeah.
Because the education beat's not busy at all, right?
No.
Nothing happening there.
Dead. It's dead.
As we'll see later in the recap, there's a lot going on there. Now, as the mayor's affordable housing initiative stalled, we are continuing to see homeless encampments growing in places like Gompers Park on the city's northwest side. So it really doesn't seem like this issue is going away anytime soon. Ray, while I have you, I want to turn to something different. The corruption trial of State Senator Emil Jones III. That is coming to a close. These were charges that were brought back in 2022. It's taken years to go to trial, and now it's just moving fast.
Moving along. It's not as complicated as the Mike Madigan trial. It took months, of course. It has closing arguments on Monday.
Okay.
We expect then to see a verdict within coming days after that.
What did we learn this week?
Well, it was really
Ray takes a deep sigh.
Well, I wasn't in the courtroom the whole time, but the time I was in there, Emil Jones was on the stand. This is the son of the former Senate President Emil Jones Jr. This is Emil Jones III, who's on trial. He's charged with taking a $5,000 bribe, trying to get his intern a job with a red light camera company, a rogue employee with the red light camera company, Safe Speed. And Omar Mani was the guy who ended up being the rogue employee who the FBI wired and had him record Emil. And at one point, Emil said that, well, you could raise me $5,000. The whole thing was that Omar was trying to slow down or restrict the study of a red light camera issue around the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so this became a situation where the feds think they've got him on that charge because they've got a tape, but that's kind of, when you're talking about raising $5,000, maybe you're just talking about a campaign fund there. And Jones on the stand this week said, I did not do anything wrong. I did not mean to take a bribe, did not include that. I thought the guy was a used car salesman-like approach, and he did a pretty good job of defending himself. So this is not a cut and dried case here, and the jury will have a lot of thinking to do before they come up with a verdict.
Mm-hmm. I want to just stick briefly with government ethics here, Heather. Chicago's watchdog, the Inspector General, issued a new report. Main takeaways?
Well, you know, I assume you're referring to the employee assistance.
I certainly am.
And she said that there's not really any evidence that the program is helping employees, that anyone is checking to make sure that the program is sort of meeting the correct standards, or that it is in any way sort of an added value for employees. And this was of interest to me because we've had a lot of attention on sort of the mental health struggles that Chicago police officers are facing. Of course, we just had an officer die by suicide not too long ago. Mm-hmm. They have a separate employee assistance program, but I think it raises real questions about how the city is administering these sort of programs.
Relations between Mayor Johnson and the White House have been tense, but they really escalated on Tuesday.
Trying to force your will to break the spirit of working people in order to have a conversation, that's terrorism. We're not going to negotiate with terrorists.
You were there, Heather. Mm-hmm. Put this in context for us.
Well, the mayor was asked about Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who, of course, ended up in the Oval Office, and she was captured by a New York Times photographer hiding her face with her binder. And he was asked whether he would go to the Oval Office and, quote unquote, kiss the ring in an attempt to convince the president not to strip federal funding from Chicago because it is a self-proclaimed sanctuary city and has an ordinance on the books that prevents Chicago police officers from helping ICE agents conduct deportation efforts. And that was part of his response. And I believe that was his response when he was asked to just clarify, sir, were you calling the president of the United States a terrorist?
And that's what he said.
That's what he said.
Well, did the reporters in the room seem shocked by the language that the mayor used?
You know, I it's hard to sort of gauge how people are feeling, you know, sort of in the moment.
Were you shocked?
So, you know, I think that you could tell that the mayor knew that he was sort of saying stuff he shouldn't necessarily say, because as he sometimes does, he says, oh, my comms team is going to be really angry with me, you know, which, you know, I assume is always a time to sort of pivot to something, you know, less controversial, but the mayor chose no. But, you know, for most Democrats, being in opposition right now and being openly and vocally in opposition to Trump is good politics. And the mayor is in a little bit more of a dicey position than perhaps other politicians, because the federal government is suing not just the city, but Cook County and the state of Illinois. And anything he says has the possibility of sort of popping up into a court filing and complicating the city's efforts to defend its law and its share of federal funding.
We're talking about a guy who's not very popular, though. And a line like that with the populace can cut through the clutter, and people will go, hey, yeah, that guy's out there fighting. Now, for all the reasons Heather just went through, it may not work well in negotiations, but it certainly did raise some huzzas out in the neighborhood. Mm.
Well, former President Joe Biden was here. He was in Chicago this week, and he was making his first speech since he left office in January, Ray. What did he have to say?
Well, he's like, man, it's not even 100 days and we've got all this destruction going on.
Sounds like
on.
He was trying to bite his tongue.
Yeah. And I think it's not always easy to do that when you're in his position and you watch all of the stuff that you've tried to do and negotiate with foreign countries and try to push through your own programs that were aimed at rebuilding some of the job growth and coming up with a fairly decent track record in the economy, even though he is criticized by all the naysayers on the opposition. So he, I'm sure, felt like he had to come out and say something, and he went to a friendly audience in Chicago. Mm. So I think he won some points. He also said, you know, all these cuts in the Social Security Department are scaring people, and we don't need to be you know, threatening the possibilities of that hurting people who get Social Security.
Yeah, well, just a day after Biden was here accusing Trump of, you know, trying to destroy Social Security.
Yeah.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell was also in Chicago and, criticizing White House policies.
Yeah.
What did he say?
Yeah, well, I brought the exact quote because, you know, these Fed guys, they get so exact. And so the level of tariff increases announced so far is significantly larger than anticipated. And that's kind of what we all knew. But he said the same is likely to be true of the economic effects, which will include higher inflation and slower growth. Our obligation is to keep longer-term inflation expectations well anchored and to make certain a one-time increase in the price level does not become an ongoing inflation problem.
And he was saying all this to the Economic Club.
Yes, and of course, in the White House, that meant alarm bells for Trump. He had to say, this guy's got to go, even though his term is not over until 2026. And it's nebulous how much power the president actually has other than just throwing firebombs at him.
Well, I've got a quote of my own, Ray.
Sorry.
Of course. Let's go quote for quote.
Because
President Trump didn't hide his anger over what Powell had to say. He said, quote, termination can't come fast enough.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, now,
he didn't like that.
Yeah, this is a lens that everybody could look through into how the Trump administration is playing things. If you don't go the way he wants it to go, then we're going to take shots at you as hard as we can.
Yeah. Lisa, you cover another group. Speaking of, here's another group not happy with the White House right now, universities.
Yes.
I want to start with the University of Illinois because we've got quite a bit to unpack here. The University of Illinois is taking action against the Department of Energy.
Yeah, that's right. So the Department of Energy basically announced that it's cutting down the rates at which it reimburses certain costs called indirect costs. We heard a lot about this with the National Institutes of Health. They had also threatened to do the same, and that was blocked. Mm-hmm. But now we have the Department of Energy trying to do that, and they fund a lot of research at University of Illinois, but at other universities in Illinois, like University of Chicago, et cetera. And this would be a drastic cut to them. Right now they get reimbursement rate at 59%, and it would be cut to 15%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's huge. That's a big and sudden drop. So the University of Illinois has signed on to this lawsuit, basically arguing that this is, I think they used the word flagrantly unlawful with a couple of other groups. So we'll see if, we saw Judge block the similar NIH cuts, so we'll see what happens.
Are we expecting that
this
might happen again, or is it just up in the air?
In this environment? I mean, yeah, I don't think we know yet.
Yeah. Northwestern University is also facing massive federal cuts. What is the latest here? I know you've been all over this, Lisa. How are students, faculty, and administration at Northwestern responding?
Yeah, I was just there yesterday for an action organized by students and faculty there to really demand that campus leaders stand up and fight Trump at this point. You know, Northwestern spent a lot of weeks trying to cooperate with Trump's like anti-DEI policies by scrubbing websites, et cetera, by trying to, highlight what it had done to combat anti-Semitism. And yet the federal government still announced it's freezing almost $800 million in research funding for the university. So students are like, if you're not going to fight back now, when are you going to do that? The administration announced yesterday that it is stepping up and funding some of the research that's been impacted by the funding freeze, but not all of it.
And I mean, they're doing really important research. I had one of the researchers on the program earlier this week. I mean, they're doing things regarding Parkinson's disease.
Yes.
And they're working on the particular researcher that was on the program was working on something about our drinking water, which affects everybody.
Yes, exactly.
So it's kind of crazy that this is happening to
them. Exactly. So the university has said we're going to step up and fund some of that while this sorts itself out. But some of the funding, like the Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Wellbeing, like a lot of their research has been impacted, and it's not clear that the university is going to step in and support that.
All right. Well, it's not over at Northwestern because the legal clinics at the law school, they were coming under congressional scrutiny. We had Carolyn Shapiro, who's co-director of Chicago Kent College of Law's Institute on the Supreme Court, yesterday on Reset. Here's a little bit of what she had to say on that.
They accused the Northwestern and this law professor of engaging in inappropriate left-wing political activity and at least promoting or protecting anti-Semitic activity, all of which is completely inappropriate and unwarranted. The law professor and the legal clinic represent clients, and clients are entitled to legal representation.
Now, Lisa, the professors from those legal clinics, they fought back.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So this congressional committee had asked for a bunch of information, including the professors' personnel files, the identities of funders. And it wasn't totally clear that the university wasn't going to provide that information. Mm-hmm. So two of the directors filed suit and were able to get, they won their suit, and this information request was blocked. And that was seen as a big victory
for
the campus.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Universities around the country, including Northwestern, I mean, they're facing overall here this difficult decision of whether to comply with the White House or whether to fight back. That seems to be the push and pull.
Yeah.
Harvard fought back. Now the Trump administration, they're like, all right, we've got a new strategy.
Yes. Yeah. So on Monday, you know, the Harvard president released this letter basically saying, like, we're not going to comply with your extensive list of demands, which included like getting rid of all of your DEI related offices. And Trump hit back and said, we're freezing $2 billion in funding. Keep in mind that Harvard has a $50 billion plus endowment. Mm-hmm. So they're in a little bit of a better position to fight back and mm-hmm. maybe to cope with this $2 billion funding freeze. But then Trump took it a step further and threatened to have the IRS revoke its tax exempt status, which it's not clear that that's legal. But even just this morning, the Education Department released this announcement that basically they're asking Harvard to provide a bunch of information, including like the records of international students who've been expelled and the identities of foreign funders, because they're alleging basically that Harvard has not accurately disclosed foreign financial contributions. Mm. So that seems to be a new front for attacking Harvard. We'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, again, slow education beat, right? Yeah. One more for you here, Lisa. The president's actions, they're impacting local universities on a different front. International students right now, they're living in fear, basically, because they're having their visas revoked.
Yes.
Another thing you've been investigating.
Yeah, at this point, more than 1,500 international students have had both their visas revoked and then their just ability to stay in the country legally terminated. I talked to a student at UIC, a recent student who basically got an email in the middle of the night saying your visa has been revoked and you're now staying in the country illegally, and didn't give a reason why.
So they're expected to leave?
Basically, and he has since left because he's like, I can't risk getting detained by ICE. And then my attorneys can't, basically, as we're seeing, you know, across the country, can't do anything about it. And colleges really don't know what to do because they're finding out about these terminations after students are. They're not being notified, which had been sort of protocol before. You know, like if a student was missing a bunch of class or, you know, failing or something, or and that was a case in which their visa might be terminated. Mm-hmm. But generally a school would be maybe making that decision and approaching the student and giving them things like due process.
But now it's happening
completely
without them.
And there's some litigation challenging this, but nothing's come of it yet.
Not so far.
Yeah.
A couple other political stories here, Ray. What's going on with Illinois Senate President Don Harmon?
Well, that's an easy one to explain.
Okay.
Basically.
You've got 30 seconds. Yeah, right.
Okay. He is accused by the State Board of Elections of accepting more than $4 million over the contribution cap limits that the board said that he was under from basically the March 24th primary on through the end of last year. Harmon disagrees with that. This week, he filed a notice that he intends to challenge and appeal that version of it. He said in an interview that he believes that he's on the right side of this and mm-hmm. that he's accepted the money. But, you know, there is a contribution cap in Illinois. It's easy to bust. There's lots of ways to do it. He thought he was in that zone where he could accept all kinds of amounts of money without caps. But the board said, no, you hadn't done all the right maneuvers to do that. And believe it or not, there are some rules. And so he's challenging the board's interpretation, and mm-hmm. it could be hearings for a few months.
Heather, in Illinois' 9th district, a 26-year-old is running against 80-year-old Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. Tell us about her.
Well, Kat Abuzela, now that's the first time I've said her name on air, and I certainly hope I didn't butcher it too terribly, but she became famous and well-known for working for Media Matters. She would take on Tucker Carlson, and she ended up in Elon Musk's crosshairs because her job was to sort of point out all of the sort of things that he was saying on X and how ridiculous they were. Now, she moved from Texas to Chicago less than a year ago, and now is running for the 9th district seat, which of course has been held by Jan Schakowsky since 1999, which is not coincidentally the same year that Kat was born.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. So I personally feel very attacked by this, but that's all right. And her pitch essentially is that, you know, Jan Schakowsky is a fine congresswoman. She's done great work. However, she's 80 and it is time for her to be retired. And she's asking the residents of a district where she does not live and has never lived to elect her to do that. And I think it's a little bit going to what she's trying to do is flies in the face of decades of Chicago politics sort of history, because very famously, and Ray will back me up here, is that we do not want nobody who nobody sends. As a native Chicagoan, I will say this, we can be a parochial people. And that is what she is sort of flying in the face of, saying that I'm going to fight Trump. I'm going to stand up for undocumented immigrants. I'm going to stand up for working class people in a way that other Democrats are not. So she is running an explicitly sort of national campaign in a district that stretches from sort of the north side of Chicago all the way out to parts of McHenry County. So it is a long, skinny, gerrymandered district.
Yeah.
I took a deep dive with my colleague Jared Brutecki into her first federal campaign finance form and found that there were only 6 contributions of more than $200, which are the ones that you have to identify by name and address, from people who actually live in the district. So those are the only people who contributed to her that will be sort of voting in that race. Now, it's early days, right?
And she collected a lot, though.
And she raised more than almost $380,000. In fact, more than Jan Schakowsky
raised.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised.
So I think it's going to be a really interesting race if it materializes. Jan Schakowsky has not said one way or another whether she's going to run for re-election. And if she does not, there are a whole host of North Side suburban politicians who have been waiting their turn.
Trying to step in there, like Double Dutch.
Right. And if Jan Schakowsky doesn't run, I would imagine who have a sort of a whole political operation and decades of service in that area will be launched to run.
Well, it only comes up every once in a while because her last, who preceded her was Sid Yates, who was there for decades himself. So this is a spot that once it's open, there's big competition, because once you got it, you got it.
Yeah. And this is the same argument that Dick Durbin is facing in the Senate. He's been in there since, I don't know, God was a child.
1997. Before Kat was born.
Right.
Well, speaking of Dick Durbin, your colleague, Rick Pearson, he wrote a fundraising story about Durbin.
Yeah, Durbin had only spent a few hundred dollars in the last quarter, and he's only raised a few thousand. And the question is, does that mean that he's not going to run for another term when his office comes up in 2026? And so there are, just as there is in the race Heather was talking about, there are a lot of people who are thinking, man, I'd like to be a U.S. senator. If Durbin doesn't go, then I'm ready to go. And that could be a bloodbath, too, because that seat, like we were just saying, hasn't been held by anybody else since 1997.
Police misconduct lawsuits have become quite the burden on taxpayers. Heather, give us the latest here.
Well, every year the city budgets a certain amount to resolve these lawsuits, either through settlements or verdicts. And this year the city set aside $82 million, and it is April, and that money is gone. The city has resolved enough lawsuits that budget has been exhausted, and the city faces hundreds of more lawsuits filed by people who believe their rights were violated by Chicago police officers, some of whom have uncontested records of misconduct. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the city council members have deep questions about what the city is going to do going forward. If the city has to pay out a number of verdicts that have come in just in the last 6 months, that could amount to nearly $200 million more. And that's being somewhat conservative. There were two men who spent a combined 32 years in prison on a murder charge that they did not commit. Mm-hmm. They were awarded $120 million. Another man was awarded $50 million for spending 10 years in prison on a murder charge he did not commit. And then there's the terrible case of a 10-year-old girl who was killed as a during an a pursuit that violated department policy.
Yeah.
Her family was awarded $80 million. Now, the city is appealing each of those verdicts, but if that appeal is not successful, that is just a massive amount of money for a city is facing a deep and significant financial crisis,
yeah.
Even if the Trump administration is unsuccessful in yanking even a single dollar of
We're
federal
just blowing
funding
through that budget. That's insane.
Yeah.
We had some sort of good news, Heather, though, about the Chicago Police Department having to do with the consent decree.
Yeah. So, you know, in the last 6 months, the police department is now in compliance with 16% of the consent decree requirements. Before that, it was only in full compliance with 9% of the consent decree. So it was the 6 month period that saw the most significant progress. And Larry Snelling, the superintendent, says it's because he has really prioritized in meeting these requirements for the consent decree. But I think a couple of caveats are needed here. One of the things that the police department is now in full compliance with is a requirement that the department report every single use of force against a Chicago resident. Now, I tell this to people in my life who are not sort of paid to focus on these things.
Yeah.
And they usually say things like, wait a minute, you mean that the police department wasn't reporting every time an officer uses force against a Chicagoan? And
no,
they were not in full compliance with that requirement of the
right.
consent decree. And so, you know, I spoke with some folks over at the ACLU of Illinois who said, you know, we sure hope that this is a signal that, you know, things are moving in a faster process. Oh, because by the way, the consent decree is 6 years old.
Yeah.
But we're not certain because there was a relatively significant increase in the number of uses of force against Chicagoans. The question is, of course, were those actually more uses of force,
mm-hmm.
or is now the police department just doing a better job of tracking it? And I don't know the answer to that question.
We had another good news story involving the police from our BEZ colleague, Chip Mitchell. He reported that Chicago robbery numbers have plunged to historic lows. You can read more about that if you're interested. It's up at WBEZ.org. We got news this week that even the Brookfield Zoo is being targeted by President Trump and Elon Musk's Doge cost-cutting initiatives.
Yes.
What is that about? What do they want with the zoo?
Yeah, good question, Sasha. So the Doge is going after the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which channels a lot of funding to libraries, zoos, museums. So I believe the Brookfield Zoo had a grant cut for an exhibit on behavioral diversity, and the word diversity may have flagged it. But people in libraries and museums are warning that these cuts are going to put, really huge libraries like the University of Illinois libraries kind of sounded the alarm about these cuts that, like, this is really going to impact our ability to preserve our collections, et cetera, down to like small suburban libraries that really rely on some of this funding to keep operating.
Oh, my goodness. Well, take us home here, Ray, because sometimes at the end of the recap, we like to look at issues impacting the media. This week, it's a new White House policy that impacts wire services. For anyone not familiar with the term, quickly, what's a wire service?
Well, I actually worked for the Associated Press for a few years, so, you can say that's a disclosure or just some perspective here on this, but I've been gone for it for years. But they are the group that they're actually like kind of like the Marines of the news service.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to go places where other news services or newspapers or TVs or radios can't go and can't be at all the time. They can't afford it. So they're like the Associated Press has people all over the world. They cover news that goes out to all these news outlets every day, mm-hmm. every minute. And so they are one of the groups that has been allowed in the White House press corps to be there every minute, along with Reuters and Bloomberg and a few other news outlets, papers, TVs, et cetera. That has been one run by the White House Correspondents Association to kind of keep peace at hand.
Right.
And yet the Trump administration—
They're trying to change that.
—has tried to change that. They got upset with AP for not calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, as Trump has decreed. They had to file a lawsuit. The judge said, okay, you should be back in the pool. You should have the ability to say what you believe is the truth. And they're an international company, so they have most places calling it the Gulf of Mexico. Now, the White House has shifted again and said, hey, we're going to change the makeup of that group that gets to go in there and mm-hmm. put the wire services into a rotation, and also have some pro-Trump news outlets, news quote-unquote outlets, involved in that mix. So this, again, like I was saying earlier, looking at the lens of the Trump folks, they're just trying to eliminate any objective review of their administration.
Following the bouncing ball here has just been so difficult. Oh, boy. Well, we'll leave it there. My thanks for WTTW's Heather Sharone, Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune, and WBEZ's Lisa Curion-Phillip. How was your first time on the recap?
Oh, it was so fun.
Yay! We'll have you back. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited and mixed by Meha Ahmed. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news you need to know in under an hour. So make sure you're subscribed to this podcast and turn those notifications on so you know when we drop episodes like The Recap. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a good weekend. Thanks for listening.
What happens when you say yes for an entire year? Join WBEZ on October 26th for an evening with Titan of Television Shonda Rhimes as she recounts lessons from her best-selling memoir, Year of Yes. Tickets at WBEZ.org/events.